Hello, everyone, and welcome to Antic the Box, a podcast by Milk and Honey PR. Today, we're joined by Dr. Nicole Brown of UCL, my ex-professor. My name is Costanza Fisogni, and let's get into it. Okay, so hi, Nicole. So, thank you so much for joining and giving us your time today.
Well, thank you very much for having me and for inviting me. It's lovely to be here.
Nicole is a very accomplished researcher in the fields of ableism in academia, disability studies, as well as many other fields that I probably haven't gotten correctly. So, Nicole, do you want to do a proper introduction yourself?
Thank you. Well, I have been doing quite a lot of research around ableism and sort of the experience of disabled academics and doctoral students in higher education. But actually, that side of it, of my work, which is, you know, quite strongly linked to any kind of activism work that I do as well, but that side of my work is actually more of a byproduct. So what I've been always really interested in is trying to explore how we can do research in a way that's accessible and that you know is enabling people to express their experiences. And I was basically just using the vehicle of chronic illnesses, neurodivergences, and disabilities as a way to explore research methods. But it's something that's really, really important to me as well. So I'm quite happy to talk about the ableism work and focus on that today, even though it's originally just kind of become like, it's taken a little bit more of my time than I had initially anticipated.
I completely understand it. When I was still at UCL, most of my time was spent trying to be an activist for mental health awareness and kind of getting the stigma out of talking and expressing our feelings, and especially are moments when it feels like everything is very overwhelming. Being a student myself, having gone through therapy, and when I found your course, I still remember it was like Busk 0039 in the list of modules that we have at UCL. I remember that I felt like, although my principal degree was not in that field, I really wanted to have an educated approach to what I was doing. And it felt, after finishing it, I really felt like that left a lasting impression. And that's why I decided to come to Milk and Honey, because they not only allow us to be the force inside of the agency promoting change, but also outside. And also talk and have a platform for people like me and so many like your students who are trying to understand how maybe when caring for someone that has a chronic illness or a disability or simply has an interest in the field, how they can make the world a better place. And at the same time, work and, you know, explore their interests and be a person in this society that is so extremely focused in accomplishments and just work.
Well, thank you. I mean, I agree with you. And in many ways, that's really what the ableism work is all about. Because, you know, people understand that there are people out there who have got disabilities or who have got chronic illnesses or who have got neurodivergences. But a lot of the time, people don't really know how to deal with those people, how to treat them, how to talk to them. It's quite interesting, really, because, I mean, recently, in the last few years, and I think COVID has got a lot to answer for in that respect, we are talking more about potential disabilities and illnesses that are invisible. But, you know, even so, you know, with visible disabilities as well, a lot of the time, people don't really know how to deal with that. And it's really quite funny. I mean, not haha funny, but more like ridiculous funny.
Yeah.
That, for example, as soon as somebody is in a wheelchair, that person in the wheelchair will be treated as if they were a little bit stupid, a little bit slow in thinking. The same is true for anyone who's visually impaired, who's got a white cane and you know doesn't see, is blind. Suddenly, yep. People talk louder to them. You know, they've got nothing wrong with their hearing. So,
exactly.
So it's that kind of thing that people are really bizarre in their behaviors, in how they are treating people with disabilities. And that's really where the ableism work comes in, because it unpicks not just the discrimination side of things, but it also unpicks that internalized ableism and that internalized way of working. And it tries to challenge our own thinking. And I'm not necessarily saying that I'm getting it right all the time. You know, I also make mistakes and I also learn, and that's okay. But it's something that's quite important, that we are sort of no longer scared of people with disabilities and chronic illnesses, that we kind of, you know, becoming a little bit more accepting, that we become a bit more aware of where our own thinking is actually quite wrong. So that's really where my work with ableism comes in.
Exactly. I know that during the classes you were quite open about your struggles with disability. I don't know if you want to share where your passion came from to begin with.
Yeah, absolutely. I have got I've got several diagnoses now, but the first diagnosis that I was given was in 2003, was fibromyalgia. And fibromyalgia is a very, very strange condition, because it's characterized by widespread pain, but also by chronic fatigue, by sleep disturbances. So on the one hand, you're completely exhausted and fatigued all the time, but on the other hand, you're really struggling to sleep very well. So it's kind of weird. And then there are psychological dysfunctions like depression attached to it. With the depression, we're not quite sure. It's a bit of a chicken and egg situation. You know, it could be that the depression is there as an underlying issue and that causes the pain. But it could also be that people are so painful, you know, they're in so much pain a lot of the time, that eventually they just get depressed about it, which is also quite feasible and makes also a lot of sense. So there is this kind of, you know, really bizarre, strange illness. And the other thing is, it doesn't show up in any test. So there is no blood test, there is no urine test, there is no test that will tell you that you definitely have fibromyalgia. So when I was given this label in 2003, I didn't actually accept it. And for many, many years, I continued going to all sorts of medical appointments, trying to figure out what's wrong with me and how I can fix myself. Until in 2013, so literally 10 years later, I came to a rheumatologist who said to me, look, have a look at your file. You have got here your medical file from the last 10 years. Look at all the information that's in here. And nothing has ever been found. Don't you think it's about time to accept that you have got fibromyalgia? And that was for me the turning point. It was at that stage where I began to kind of accept the diagnosis. And I treated myself differently. I treated my body differently. And I no longer fought against the, you know, until then, I would have just tried to live my life as normally as possible. But that was the turning point where I realized, well, actually, you know, it's true. Nothing's ever been found. So I'm better just get on with it. And that meant that, for example, in restaurants, I no longer sit under the air condition because I know that the air condition causes me pain. It's always caused me pain. But even in that time between 2003 and 2013, I ignored that and I would have sat underneath the air condition, whereas now I'm no longer doing that. And it's little things like that that have actually made a massive a massive difference to my life and my experience and my lived experience of being ill. So whilst I still obviously have got that condition underlying and I've got good days and bad days like everybody, overall, I'm dealing with it a lot better than I used to. And that's part of that also, that internalized ableism that came to the fore there. It was a case of I couldn't accept that I would have had a body that's failing me, that I had a body that didn't like me, that I didn't like. So it was that kind of, you know, struggle that I had. And that is something that came out also in a lot of my research, where people kind of have got that experience when they're given a diagnosis, they're really struggling to come to terms with it. And that's really where all my interest in the research really began.
Yeah, you're saying so many things. I could probably go on for hours and hours, but I will restrict myself to say, first of all, thank you so much for disclosing it. Not a lot of people, unfortunately, feel comfortable with disclosing what they're going through. If there were more, I think that we would be in a better place, especially seeing other movements, how they've grown and how they've grown in relevance. But also, you've underlined something that I think we will be talking about later on today, which is people who have a invisible or visible disability or chronic illness are not only struggling with the external world, they're also struggling with their internal world, because every single day you're not only in pain or, you know, suffering in some way, but you're also every single day having to come to terms with what's happening with your body. And especially, you know, it's not a static condition. It's something that changes. No. It's something that can get worse.
Yes, absolutely. And what also happens then is that because other people don't see it, you know, other people may only see me on a day where 1 minute I'm doing really well, and the next minute I'm like, I can't actually walk. I need to sit down, and I can't, you know, I just need a break. So it's very difficult for other people. I mean, if you yourself don't quite understand it, other people find it even more difficult to understand. And it's the fluctuating illnesses and the fluctuating energy levels that people have with certain kinds of conditions that make it really difficult to kind of, sort of follow that logic and really understand, well, what is happening here? You know, it's something that's really difficult to explain. It's like, well, actually, I just need a minute now. Just give me a minute.
Exactly. You're completely correct. Now, I wanted to bring in two major things that a lot of people who are entering the workforce kind of have to deal with. Well, three, actually. Yeah. The first one is the obstacles of disclosure or not disclosure, which I am sure we will go into in a second. The secondary thing is the issue of explaining your symptomatology. They are different for every person, so you can't have a pre-established procedure, and therefore the third main point, which is the laws or the procedures that are in point in many places for HR when it comes to illnesses or any kind of sick leave or sick procedures, don't often apply or don't apply well to invisible, visible disabilities or chronic illnesses.
And that's something that a lot of the participants in my different research projects were talking about, actually, that element of, you know, well, how can I explain to somebody that I may need time off to go to the doctors, and then I may need time for the rest of the day because I have got that, you know, flare up after having been to the dentist or to the doctor's appointment. That is something that's really difficult for people to understand. I mean, I personally think that the COVID has helped in some way, because people have experienced, you know, like that energy issue, that fluctuating energy issue. So in that respect, people have got a little bit more awareness of it. But unfortunately, in many ways, unfortunately, people forget very quickly. So whilst they may have had that experience during the COVID period themselves, because we are kind of out of that immediate threat, people have forgotten about it. And that's where, like you say, you know, that kind of explaining to other people comes back in. And that is really, really quite demanding on the person. It's quite a lot of emotional labor that you have. It's about trying to kind of deal with other people's experiences. So, for example, a lot of, in my research, a lot of people were talking about, I can't really tell what I, you know, others, what I need in terms of how I can better deal with my symptoms. Because if I do, then they will treat me differently and actually treat me back quite badly. And they may be jealous and envious. And it's really strange to think of it like that. But picture yourself in an environment where there is an open plan office and everybody has to share this one big room with like loads of different desks and chairs. And then there is one office which is closed off. And the one person that has got that closed off office is the person that has got some kind of disability or illness. Well, isn't it like everybody would like to have that, you know, sort of closed off office for themselves as well? So you know, you're suddenly dealing with, well, I need to look after myself. I don't know, it's maybe, for example, the flickering light in the open plan office that doesn't work for me. So I need to look after myself. I can't be in the flickering light of the open plan office. I get the private office. Well, other people would like to have that private office too. So I'm now dealing with my symptoms, my body, as well as the emotions of other people, not even my own emotions. And that's a lot of the kind of the emotional labor and the difficult task that people have. And what it comes down to in the end is obviously, like you've mentioned, is then the disclosure. You know, well, do you say that you have got a need, or do you then just pretend, well, I can get on with it in the open plan office? Yes, it will be painful for me, but at least I don't have to deal with these people. So there is that kind of thing where people who have got disabilities or chronic illnesses or neurodivergences are genuinely considering the benefits and the cost. And the cost are things like, you know, having to explain yourself to other people, but it could also be stigma. There are certain conditions and neurodivergences and disabilities that are highly stigmatized in contemporary society still. Shouldn't be, but still are. So in that respect, people are probably more likely to kind of, you know, like not disclose them and just kind of say, well, I try to muddle my way through and not having to deal with that openly and transparently, because I know that I'm going to be ridiculed if people know about my stigmatizing illness. So there is that. The other thing is also, it's not just that cost of it, it's also the flip side, you know, the benefit. What benefit do I get from telling people that I've got this condition? And that may be some, you know, for some people, going back to the higher education context, in higher education, it may help students because they get extra time for their exams, or they get extra software packages or laptops or whatever to support them with their learning. But for a lot of people that are working in higher education, for staff, there isn't any benefit. So why would you tell someone that you've got a condition when you're roping in all of the disadvantages, that everybody is going to be, you know, treating you differently, you know, that whose emotions you're having to look after, and yet you're not getting the benefits of the support. So what's the point? And that's why a lot of people are not disclosing. And this is why I'm personally very, very grateful for the people that have contributed to my books. So I've got two books out already. One is Ableism in Academia, and the other one is Lived Experiences in Ableism in Academia. And all of those chapters in those two books have been written by people who have got some form of experience of disability, chronic illness, and neurodivergence. And they put themselves out there very, very openly about their experiences. And that's something that I'm really, really proud of. And I'm very grateful for too. And there's going to be a third book, which is coming out next year, which is going to be called Exceptionally Able. And that one, yes. And that one is actually creative responses. So people writing creatively about their experiences with disabilities. So that's something that I'm really, really looking forward to seeing that third volume, if you like, of that trilogy coming together now. So that's really, and again, there were loads of people who contacted me. I think there are a couple of people who are writing under a pseudonym, but everybody else is writing under their real name. And it's, again, it's that kind of openness about their experiences that I'm really, really grateful for.
Yeah, definitely. I remember the story from one of your books. I think it was Lived Experience in Academia. Ableism in Academia, sorry. Of this professor who had an accident while she was hiking or rock climbing, and she was alive by a miracle. Like she could have died in that accident, and she went back to teaching, but unfortunately, like, the chair where she was sitting was not appropriate for her condition with her back. And she had to fight a lot of different situations. And here I wanted to kind of, I would stay for hours to talk about all of the different stories of literal heroes who I think should be talked more about. They should be the real influencers in our lives, but including you. But I think that a lot of students and young early careers people kind of ask themselves that, of course, have some kind of disability or chronic illness, or like, well, will I be able to enter the workforce, and will I be able to do the same job that I always wanted to do, but now that I have been diagnosed, or now that I have this disability. And also, you know, when you do an interview or when you do your you're in Excel, you have to do a lot of tests. You feel like maybe you simply cannot. You're just like not allowed to do them anymore. And what would you say to these people who are experiencing this situation?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, it depends on which country context we're talking about as well. So, you know, countries are very, very different. I would say that within the UK, higher education within the UK has moved massively over the last few years. So when I first began to explore ableism in academia in 2017, 18, around that time, I was probably one of very, very few people talking about what it feels like to be disabled in the academic workforce. That's changed now. There have been many other people who have written about it. They are writing from their personal experiences, that are writing from research projects that they are doing. So we can see that there is movement here where it becomes a little bit more commonplace to think that, you know, someone who's working in higher education isn't necessarily fully able-bodied all the time. So that seems to be a little bit more accepted. But then I'm looking at some of the other countries that I have been, sort of involved with through colleagues, through friends, through family, through invitations to, you know, collaborations, etc. And I'm looking at those countries, and I'm kind of thinking, well, actually, you're even further behind. So there is something there that, you know, it really depends on each context that you're working within, whether you want to mention that you've got a disability or not. And in some countries, I would say there is so much stigma attached to the disability that it is better not to. That is generally better not to. And I'm specifically looking towards Asian countries here. In countries like Japan, South Korea, they're very Hong Kong as well. They're very, very high-powered countries where any kind of mention of mental health issues is coming with so much stigma that's attached to it that you are generally, you know, ousting yourself in society. So in those kind of settings, it's better not to. When it comes to countries like the UK that are a little bit more sort of further ahead that thinking, I would suggest that it depends on where in your career you are. Again, I wouldn't necessarily recommend early careers people entering the workforce to disclose all of their needs. I would generally not advise that because you can't take it back. It's something, it's a bit, little bit like social media. You know, you're not sharing on social media the kinds of things that, you know, that you don't want your grandma to know about you. You know what I mean? So there are certain things, certain photographs that you may be showing to your friends, but you're not putting them on social media. And I think that is the same for disclosing disabilities, because once it's out there, it's going to be very difficult to rein it back in. Which is why, you know, I'm always sort of trying to say to people, be careful about, you know, what kind of statements that you make. But obviously, on the other hand, sometimes it is necessary to make those statements, because without any support, you may not be able to do the job. And that's not ideal either. So you're going to have to really balance out, again, that cost-benefit analysis, really balance out how much do you say and who you're saying it to. Because just because you're saying it once doesn't mean that you have to say it all the time to everybody. Maybe you can, you know, just mention it to HR and your line manager, but not mention it to many other people unless you really trust them. So trying to sort of negotiate that space. Not everybody has obviously got the benefit of being able to do that, especially if you've got a disability that's you know, sort of quite visible. Or if you've got a disability that requires you to have a particular kind of equipment, like a wheelchair, you're not going to be able to pretend that you don't have the wheelchair. So that's something that's always going to be there. But a lot of chronic illnesses and a lot of neurodivergences, people can sort of negotiate for themselves and manage their identity and manage what they want to share.
I understand completely. Yes, unfortunately, it is still the situation. Now, what would you say, given all of the different experiences that you heard, you wrote about, helped write about, or collected, are the things that we should do as a society to move forward and increase the possibilities for people that have invisible or visible disabilities or mental or chronic illnesses in the workforce?
Yeah, I think the important thing is that we need to raise awareness of those things, and we need to be good allies. So, for example, if anyone sees an issue in the office, even if it doesn't affect you personally, do try and have it fixed. So, for example, in meetings, when there are no microphones being used, although there are microphones in the room, say, you know, I don't need you to use the microphone. I can hear you without it. But let's use the microphone just in case somebody in here does need us to use the microphone, because they wouldn't hear otherwise, or wouldn't hear very well otherwise. Same thing, you know, if you see that flickering light in the office that I mentioned earlier, I mean, the flickering light can be very, very, really, really difficult to navigate for people especially with things like epilepsy or processing disorders, sensory processing disorders, you know, those kinds of things. Then rather than just ignoring it, report it. Make sure that flickering light gets fixed. When you see a toilet that's broken, don't just accept it and go and find another toilet. Well, lucky you can go and find another one, but the next person may not be able to. So again, record it, report it, make sure that it's getting fixed. It's those kinds of things, those little things where each and every one of us can do something to make life better for someone else. And that's the kind of thing that I suggest is the most important. So it's trying to raise awareness, and through reporting these things, you are automatically raising awareness, because you kind of say to other people, look, I'm being a good role model here. I have seen this. I am reporting this. I'm trying to make sure that it gets fixed. And it's those little things that really make the life much better for anyone who is disabled, so that they don't have to do all the lobbying work for themselves all the time. So any kind of support that we can give to the disabled community is really important. And then the second part to that, I would say, is to listen to the disabled community. That's the next part. A lot of the time, like I said to you earlier, when people see someone in a wheelchair, they treat them as if they were a little bit stupid. Well, they're not stupid people just because they're sitting down in a wheelchair. So let's treat them with respect. Let's treat everyone with all kinds of conditions with respect. Let's listen to their experiences, and let's try and find out what it is that we can do in the long term. There may well be something specific that a person can do, but unless you speak to those people, you won't know about it. So it's that kind of thing that's really important: raising awareness, being a good ally, and listening to the people. I think these are the three things that I would usually sort of recommend that everybody can do, and that they don't even cost anything.
No, exactly. I completely understand. For example, I don't know if you're aware, but the temperature and the lighting inside of offices nowadays is regulated for men wearing a full wool three-piece in the 60s. Now, if you think about it, the workforce now, it's at least 40% women that usually have a metabolism that is 20% lower than men, which means that they produce less heat. And also they tend to dress not in full like wool suits anymore. So most women feel cold in workplaces. Yes. And for example, I remember I once was in an office and I went into the reception and I was just like, I'm freezing. Can you just like tell me how to lower the thermostat for my office? And they were like, the thermostat is set for the entire work, like for the entire building.
Yes.
And I was like, we are not the same. Like, we want to be treated the same, yes, but we're just not the same. No, so it's something that, yeah, exactly. It's so little, like such little things. And also I would add, like, if it was just me, it's like, for example, another thing is like, don't make it hard on a person. Exactly. Do not treat them differently. For example, just very funnily, I sometimes when I have my headaches, I have to wear sunglasses at the office because like the light hurts me. But I don't want to miss a day at work because, you know, I care about what I'm doing. And so I wear sunglasses, and it's kind of weird because, like, you know, I'm in an office completely normally dressed and I'm like wearing sunglasses as if, like, I don't know, I drank the night before or something. And no one says anything in Milk and Honey. And it's something that makes me feel so nice and so well, knowing that no one is judging and no one is making jokes about it. Whereas maybe when I was in, you know, high school, maybe, or university, people would make jokes about it. And that's something that makes me feel like I can be myself.
I agree with you. That is so important. And I also sometimes have in my office, well, I don't actually have an office anymore now. So I've got it in my cupboard that is in my locker. But in my locker, I do have some bits and pieces that are helpful for other people as well. So I have got like a cardigan there. So if anyone is cold, I've got a cardigan that I can, you know, help out with.
Exactly.
I've got some muesli bars in there. So in case anyone's sugar level drops for whatever reason, there is some food there that is going to help you spike your sugar back up. So it's like little bits like that that I always have in my office or in the locker now. Just to make people comfortable, like you say, at the end of the day, we don't want to, you know, we don't want to make life more difficult for people. It's not necessary to do that.
Exactly. We're the same. I have protein bars, like not the proper protein bars, the naked protein bars, which are like unless you're allergic to nuts, they're completely like safe and they're sourced sustainably and everything like that. I always keep them in the office because a lot of people sometimes they get lost at work, and so I just go around and be like, have you had lunch? Just protein bar. Have you had lunch? Yeah. Protein bar. Just exactly. To make sure. Anyways, I mean, it's been amazing chatting with you, honestly. And I thank you so much for coming on. I hope to chat in the future, maybe about even more specific things. And again, please go out and buy Nicole Brown 3 Book Saga, actually 2 for now, which is Ableism in Academia and Lived Experience of Ableism in Academia, if I'm correct.
Yes, that's correct. Thank you.
Perfect. And we will see you in a month. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you so much, Nicole.
Thank you very much for having me. And yeah, look forward to connecting again.